Afternoon now, it's 12:09, and this is the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. I'll be here until 1 o'clock. Then Anna DeVlantis will entertain, inform, and improve you, I might add, at almost 12:10. So we'll start today with Lise Glink. Lise is a regular on this show. Sometimes she hosts these shows. And Lise, I've been looking at some of your notes about the market, about what's leading the market, and also about people's credit scores. Where should we start here today?
Oh, there's so much good stuff. Let's start with the market, which everybody should feel good about, as it's up 430-something points right now. It's interesting to me that what seems to be driving the market today, and honestly, you never know, right, John? But this idea that maybe we're going to get the out-of-control coronavirus under control in Texas, Arizona, and Florida, just the hope of that seems to be driving the market today.
Yeah. It's funny because it's been very bad news there, but it's so precipitous. You're right. It's just the hope of maybe some of these vaccine tests that we've been talking about today are also giving people, you know, pause for being hopeful. But 400 points, we're up on the Dow right now, huh?
Yeah, it feels, though, that we should be careful and cautious in thinking that there may be a pullback. There's some conversations going on online about how the Robinhood traders may be overextended and pushing the market, that there may be another 20% dip coming forward as we see some of these different things. Some will work, maybe, we hope, many will not. So anyway, as you're out there investing your dollars, think about the long term and don't try to day trade, because that almost never works for anybody.
If we do open the country back up, then people will fly. If people will fly, then that's good for Boeing. And Boeing is one of the stocks that are leading the Dow today, right?
They are. I mean, people have a lot of extra planes right now. They're mostly parked in places like Arizona in the desert where they keep them from getting rusty. But yes, there are a lot of there's a lot of hope that Boeing, which had been so badly beaten down, may be making a bit of a comeback.
Later this week, we've got a bunch of economic data coming forward, including the jobs reports. The June jobs report will come out Thursday morning. I'm reading from finance.yahoo right now. The release will coincide with the Labor Department's weekly report on new unemployment insurance claims, which is expected to show another 1.3 million individuals filing new jobless claims the weekend of June 27th, down just slightly from the worse than expected almost 5 million reported last week. You were also looking at people's, pardon me, Elise, you wanted to say something about that.
No, I was just going to say how dreadful. What's Thursday?
Yeah.
Thursday is going to be a day full of really, I think, unsettling news as we go into the second half of this year.
Talk to me about credit scores, the resilience score. What is this?
This is a new score that FICO, used to be known as Fair Isaacs Corporation. They're the ones who invented the credit score like 30 years ago. They've now started to look at a different score modeling that calculates borrowers' financial resiliency during economic downturns. What is this? This is, so everybody is familiar with the credit score that goes up to 850. And what that does is predict what kind of a risk you're going to be in terms of paying back loans or credit that's extended to you. But guess what? It's not very accurate when it comes to these massive downturns. And so FICO has spent the last couple of years trying to model something by looking at 70 million credit scores and financial records where they could find who might have a lower credit score because perhaps they lost a job and then they had a, let's say, a medical bill that didn't get paid, or they went into forbearance with some of their accounts, but were able to come back after a few years. And how might you continue to extend credit to them? And so this new score, which is going to be on a scale of 1 to 99, you know, in the old scoring model, if you had an 850, you had the highest score. But now a number 1 is going to mean that you're most resilient. So there's going to be a lot of work for FICO and others that model against this to come forward and teach consumers like us how to understand the score, because it's not very intuitive.
I know you want to be in the 700 club. I wonder, then you probably want to be in the less than 3 club or something like that.
Yeah, you want to be in the 1 to 44 club versus the 800 plus club. And like, you can just imagine how confusing that's going to be.
But then also, but it does sound like if you contextualize people's economic problems, then maybe their scores will be better and they'll have a better chance of borrowing money, and they're good for those loans. I wonder if the reverse is true, though, too, that you will discover some people maybe aren't as good a risk as they look.
Yeah, I think that we're going to see there will be some unintended consequences here, and I think people who have a lot of money, nobody understands what this new score is actually based on. So until that's better understood, and until we understand sort of, does having money in the bank help you with resiliency? Yes, but how would they even measure that, since that's not part of our credit scores? What else are they looking at and measuring? That's going to be the big question.
Just quickly, give me one last thought on homeowners facing flood risks. What are you talking about here?
You know, this is the time of year where we start really worrying about flooding. We saw it here in Chicago, wettest May in history, followed by last year and the year before as the other two wettest Mays in history. We also had a ton of rain in April. And oftentimes, September is extremely wet here. And we see the Chicago River, Des Plaines River rise up and it floods and you hear a lot about it. Well, this is the time of year where we now start thinking about hurricanes and what's going on in the entire East Coast and, of course, the Gulf Coast. And what we're seeing is that, you know, with climate change, and I know that's gotten drowned out right now by a lot of stuff around coronavirus and the economics and Black Lives Matter, but flood, this is a very substantial flood time, and we are seeing more properties at risk of substantial flooding now than ever before, and it's extraordinarily expensive. So, you know, this is a good time for you to look and see if you've got flood insurance. It's only available from the federal government. If you've got an expensive product, home property, you can actually buy something above that from your private insurer. But this is the time to really be thinking about what's going on with your insurance, because regular homeowners insurance doesn't cover it. And every year, every decade, we see the cost of these catastrophic storms go up by 10 times, which ultimately gets pushed back to you and me.
Yeah, no kidding. Elise Glink, visit thinklink.com. Thanks for your time today, Elise.
You bet, John.
I can tell you, in my travels up and down the Stevenson over the weekend, I was on Lakeshore Drive, and a lot of city streets, that there is more and more city traffic and there is more and more highway traffic. Still not what it was, though. I used to drive to my folks' house in Joliet on weekends. I still do. So I go from Wrigley Field down Lakeshore Drive to the Stevenson all the way down to Joliet. And that would be stop and go through the city in the olden days. Now I'm still doing the speed limit, and some of you are doing 80 right next to me. The only place it gets a little slow now is on Lakeshore Drive in parts, at least on weekends. During the week and weekend, I've noticed that the city traffic is getting busier and busier. But I would say that it is still well less than 50% of what it used to be. There's a little traffic commentary from your friend John Williams. Jim Dahlke is a senior editor at Chicago Inno, joins us weekdays about this time. Hey, Jim, how are you today?
Hey, John, doing great. Thanks for having me.
What city are you in?
I am out in the western burbs in Geneva.
Have you noticed, well, then maybe traffic's never an issue for you guys there anyway, huh?
Yeah, definitely less, you know, not a huge impact out here, but I can tell you that, you know, I'm definitely not on the metro train every day like I used to. So I can imagine that there are a lot of suburban commuters like me who are maybe avoiding the metro right now. And if they are headed downtown, like you mentioned, they're probably a reason for that slight uptick in traffic you're seeing.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. If people are socializing, if not going to work on the trains anymore. I noticed, for instance, on my ride down this morning in the city, at 6:45, a CTA bus that would have normally been full had five people on it. Five people on it. I took the L last Friday, and there were 9 people on my car. And that's just crazy town. That's just crazy. By the way, I saw this story, Cards Against Humanity co-founder stepping down after allegations that it was a much more toxic workplace than I guess any of us knew. I don't follow Cards Against Humanity that closely. We've interviewed the creators of it. They sound like fun people. It sounded like a fun company. What's been happening here?
Yeah, you know, over the years, Cards Against Humanity has really, you know, kind of skyrocketed to be kind of a, you know, a stalwart institution in, you know, Chicago's creative community. I mean, Cards Against Humanity has been, you know, among the most popular card games, you know, across the country. I think they're number one on Amazon, big seller at places like Target. Card game just is extremely, extremely popular. And, you know, earlier this month, you know, sort of discussions on social media really began to come up from former employees that were really kind of describing a toxic workplace, kind of from the top down, and instances of alleged racism and sexism, and you know, these were kind of bubbling on social media, and you know, hadn't really heard anything from the company. And then, you know, just last week the company came out with a long statement and announced that indeed that its co-founder Max Temkin had stepped down from the popular card game, and that officially took place on June 9th, and he no longer has a role with the company. Temkin was, you know, really kind of the, you know, in some ways the face of the business. There's about eight co-founders at Cards Against Humanity, eight guys who kind of launched this company out of college. And he continues to hold a 1/8 share in the business, but, you know, no longer has an active role in the company, no longer has a salary. And so, you know, it's just a really interesting story, right, to see, you know, this very well-known Chicago brand have their kind of biggest face of the business step down from the company.
Is that an admission on his part?
So the company in their statement definitely acknowledged that there were you know, some workplace issues that should have been addressed and should have been handled differently. The company mentioned in their statement that they are bringing on, you know, an HR firm essentially to kind of come in and clean up some of the workplace issues that were going on in the business. I think, you know, what you found at Cards Against Humanity happens at a lot of small businesses, right? So small companies founded by a bunch of friends, you know, HR typically is not the first thing they're thinking about, right? But I think what's going to change, especially in small businesses and early stage startups, is that these companies are going to focus on HR from day one, and it's not going to be an afterthought and something that they figure out down the road.
Boy, especially right now, just look how the whole marketplace, how businesses and names of things are changing. You have to be attuned to this. You should have been all along. But a company like that, which is so irreverent, the game that they've created plays off of cringe-worthy word statements and phrases, so I could see how, I'm not justifying it, I'm saying maybe I should not be shocked that if it were somewhere, it would be there, because their very culture is irreverence, right?
And writers' rooms in those environments are very tricky situations too, right? And I think that writers' rooms, you know, in a place like Cards Against Humanity or in a television show or any kind of place where you have a bunch of creative people coming together to try to create jokes, you know, while you're trying to push the envelope, you have to be respectful of your coworkers. I mean, that's just the bottom line, is that you have to create a workplace that is safe and comfortable for the people who are there. And, that, you know, that takes more precedent than trying to be edgy with your jokes.
Speaking of which, there's an app. Is this an app called Chill Anywhere, or is that a website? What is this?
Yeah, so Chill Anywhere is an app, both on Apple and Android, and this is a new Chicago-based company, and they are creating a meditation app specifically aimed at businesses. So it's kind of an interesting approach. They're taking the B2B aim at this, where apps like Calm and Headspace have really kind of taken more of a you know, a B2C approach. Chill Anywhere is really targeting businesses. So kind of in this, you know, current COVID climate, right, where your remote distributed workforce is probably feeling very anxious and very overworked and very stressed out, Chill Anywhere wants to kind of come in here and create an app that allows businesses to really tap into the mental well-being of their employees and get a sense for how their employees are feeling and give them a tool and some resources to meditate and to de-stress a bit.
Do these things work? I mean, like, what am I looking at? Am I listening to some music, or am I repeating a mantra? How does it work, and does it work?
So you've got a meditation coach who's leading you on the app kind of through the different meditation exercises. So these are breathing exercises, exercises to just kind of calm down what's going on in your brain, right? And so, what Chill Anywhere says is their data shows that, people feel better after going through a session. So you kind of, at the beginning of the app, sort of answer a few questions on how you're feeling. You do the app, you do the meditation session, and then at the end, you answer how you're feeling kind of post-meditation. And what they say is that, yes, people who do the app feel better after they're doing it. And, kind of the interesting thing for Chill Anywhere is that then they're providing that information back to the businesses. So the business knows, hey, our HR team is more stressed out than the finance team, or more stressed out than the sales team, or our Chicago branch is more stressed out than our New York branch. So they're able to kind of use that data to then, proactively go to their employees and kind of give them additional resources to make sure their mental health is where it needs to be.
Jim Dahlke's on the line, the senior editor at Chicago Inno. Your website is reporting student loan debt is at an all-time high, with more than 45 million borrowers owing a total of $1.5 trillion, which, as I recall, was about where the housing debt was before the crash. What are you guys saying about that, and what does this Chicago company have to do with all of this?
Yeah, so there's a really interesting Chicago startup called AM Money, so A.M. Money, and they have created kind of a new way for students to get loans for undergraduate colleges. And so, they have taken an approach that uses some unconventional factors for deciding whether a student qualifies for a loan. So rather than needing a cosigner or looking at your credit score, AM Money gives students loans based on things like how long they've been pursuing a college education and what classes they take and actually what grades they get in those courses. So really kind of taking a completely new approach at how they're giving loans to students. So they're working through Bank of Lake Mills up in Wisconsin to do the lending and kind of focusing initially on sort of the region here and students in Chicago, and actually been backed by some pretty big names in the startup space, Light Bank out here in Chicago, Don Thompson, the former CEO of McDonald's. So interesting traction for a group that's taking a pretty unconventional approach at student loans.
Well, they're lending money. I'm wondering, then whose money are they lending? This is it venture capitalist money? And then what rate are they charging to make any money back?
Yeah, so the loans are facilitated through Bank of Lake Mills up in Wisconsin, and in their undergrad loan, they have a 7.08% fixed rate interest. So that's what they're offering in their undergrad loan, and then they have a grad school loan that they say is on their website coming soon. So hopefully more details on that. But yeah, I mean, really kind of targeting, borrowers who maybe have no credit, maybe have bad credit, kind of taking an unconventional approach at giving loans to some deserving students.
Interesting. AM Money, a Chicago startup. All right, let's follow them down the road. Thanks for your time this morning, this afternoon, rather.
Thanks, John. Happy to be here.
That's Jim Dahlke, senior editor at Chicago Inno. It's 12:34. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John. I'm John Williams, and Philip Weiss is on a phone line, president of Safe Arth at Work. Let's talk a little bit about how people are working these days. Philip, welcome back. How are you today?
Great, John. Thanks for having me again.
I just think as we get closer and closer to businesses opening up, or as they've opened up and are evolving that, they're getting more and more open, if you will, they need to be thinking about some of the ways to effectively and safely do that. You've been writing and thinking about that too, right?
Absolutely. And what's interesting is every couple weeks, there seems to be another issue that's top of mind for bosses and managers. Now, as we've hit the midsummer time of year, it seems that a lot of bosses are focusing on the traditional company picnic or outing and wondering, should they do it? And if so, just how they can make it safe.
I thought when I saw the company picnic, that was just an expression. Literally, the company picnics?
Literally, the company picnic. And you'd think we'd have weightier issues given all that's happening out in the streets and in the minds of employees. But I was with a team of executives virtually last week, John, and the discussion basically veered off into a pretty heated debate on whether or not the July 4th picnic is a safe and good idea for their employees and companies.
Well, that's interesting, or more relevant now that you mention it. Here's the 4th of July. I thought you were going to be talking about conferences, you know, people all gathering in a room to discuss some issue at work, rather than them all gathering outside at a picnic. What did you all... Go ahead.
No, that was exactly my assumption, John, that the issue and the areas of concern would be about people together indoors where we know the risk is a lot higher. And in phase four that we're entering together, outdoor recreation is not considered a risk area and certainly not a major risk area. But the fact is, when people in a company or on a team get together, they're often playing games, sharing food in close proximity. Three types of activities that raise the specter of risk dramatically.
I suppose that, an outdoor picnic for the company and the staff, and boy, we could all use some socialization and the fun and the food of that, while that would be much less dangerous, much safer, it's also not necessary. Like, it's a risk you could completely avoid as well. Did you all come to any conclusions about what companies should do about social gatherings this 4th of July?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you really articulated the mindset of a lot of leaders. Because on the one hand, there's this sort of this need to rush back to normalcy. And nothing spells the old days as well as an event where people can come together, enjoy themselves, and build team morale. But to your point, it's really not a business imperative. And a lot of employees who've been attending these picnics and outside outings in the last week or two have already been expressing concern and experiencing unanticipated risks. We actually, to illustrate, we have an accounting firm we work with, and a lot of the employees are in their 60s and 70s. The bosses thought, let's be extra careful. Let's pick a location that's secluded, that's far away, so we can enjoy the outdoors together. In fact, John, they picked a site that was too far away. A number of employees had to take two, if not three, buses to reach the picnic site from their homes. They were exposed for that reason. And when they arrived at the site to enjoy themselves, unbeknownst to the planners, some local parents had set up kind of an impromptu kids' camp right next door. So kids were running all over the area, some coughing, screaming, etc. The whole event unnerved the employees as opposed to built the camaraderie that was anticipated.
You listed five simple steps to stay clear of COVID-related picnic problems. Picnic problems, not the picnics. If you're going to do it, well, here's number one. Maybe wait a year. Okay,
that's right.
That solves that problem. Number two, miniaturize your picnic. I suppose that's self-explanatory, but just expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, and you're right. If you can pass on the picnic, you ask me what's the best advice, it's probably take a pass for 1 year. But if you're going to do it, if you're dead set on it, miniaturizing, keeping it small, is critically important. We've gotten some clients sharing with us that they created, in essence, fabric cutouts, kind of donut-shaped cutouts, John, and they set these around trees with seating spots specifically designated so people knew where to sit. Managing that location, making sure you pre-visit the site, really critical. And if you have your own green space as a company, you've got your own private area that's adequately sized, definitely use it. So one is manage the location, but you also want to manage the activities and the rules you set for people so they know not to engage in the kind of physical free-for-all that's going to result in possible risk.
If you go to Lincoln Park Zoo, which is a nice kind of outdoor place to stroll through, they want you to keep your mask on as you stroll through the zoo. If you go to Brookfield Zoo, they want you to have a mask on when you come in, but then you can take it off as long as you socially distance. So two very similar places with somewhat different approaches to the masks. What do you say?
Yeah, the masks are really essential from a company standpoint because you can't totally control the movement of your people. And if you're going to have the picnic, you want the protection. So number one, the masks are important unless, of course, people are eating. And that kind of links us to another really important point, which is if food will be consumed, which it usually is, best if people bring their own supplies and provisions. Not so much the risk of carry-out or ordering food, but it's more the risk of people sharing, touching, and coming in close contact. So masks and have them make their own food and bring it with them, those are two really critical advantages.
Well, then maybe we'll just skip the damn picnic.
You may want to. You can plan carefully. Don't pressure people, but maybe just put it off. That might be the best advice of all.
I mean, hey, listen, y'all do what you want to do, but if I got to wear a mask and bring my own food that we could have eaten back at my place, but that ignores the camaraderie, the socialization to the degree you can. I mean, I'm not against these things. In fact, about that, you said you should modify the game. So the wheelbarrow races, I guess, are off this year?
Yeah, they certainly are. Capture the flag, tug of war, anything where people will end up in a large pile of humanity, or closer than comfort allows or safety allows. You want to trade those out, John, for the kind of contactless activities that we all know of, charades, company quizzes, all kinds of back and forth that don't require us being in such close contact with one another. You know, your point about is it even worth it? It's a great question. A lot of employees appreciate the effort and the intention that companies are putting in, but we want to be thoughtful about the results.
Now, that's why you do what you do. Nice to talk to you, Philip. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Now, that's Philip Weiss. He's the president of Safe Hearth at Work. More advice like that at safehearth.com, SEYFARTH, Safe Hearth. .com. It's 12:41. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. We're learning more now just about how dependent airlines are on those frequent flyer mile programs. Cranes points out United had to disclose the information when it borrowed money against the program. Turns out the frequent flyer program generates about 25% of United's annual operating revenue. While we're in the air, the U.S. aviation regulators say they've approved a critical set of test flights for Boeing 737 MAX. They could begin today. The 737 MAX has been grounded for well over a year after two catastrophic crashes. And Chicago Innos has a new venture capital firm based in Columbus raised a new fund to invest in LGBTQ founders as well as startups that serve the community. Loud Capital raised $10 million this month. The fund will be based in Chicago. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
Orion Samuelson's looking at the agribusiness scene. Go ahead, O.
Pretty good action in the agricultural markets today. The July wheat contract is trading up 13 and a quarter cents a bushel. The July corn contract is up 8 cents a bushel. And the July soybean contract is trading up 3/4 of a cent a bushel. Livestock futures, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, July lean hog contract up 17 cents a hundredweight. June live cattle contract up 22 cents. And the August feeder cattle contract is up 77 cents. Well, in this year of an unusual summer situation for county fairs, state fairs, FFA state conventions, it continues to be an unusual summer. Over the weekend, you may have missed this, the National FFA Organization announced the 2020 National FFA Convention and Expo will be held virtually. And the association announced it has extended its contract with the host city of Indianapolis from 2031 to 2033. But that means there'll be no auditoriums or no Lucas Oil Stadium filled with blue jacketed FFA members. It will be conducted virtually. But on the other side of the issue, the Illinois Department of Agriculture announced it will host junior livestock and horse shows to provide Illinois young people with an opportunity to show their animals during the show season. The Junior Livestock Expo will take place in Springfield over the course of two weekends in September. Beef, sheep, dairy goats, pygmy goats, and rabbits will all show September 11 through 13. Swine, dairy cattle, and meat goats will have their turn in the show ring on September 18 through 20. And a junior horse show will take place on the DuQuoin State Fairgrounds. That show will run for 2 weekends on the DuQuoin State Fairgrounds, with English horses showing August 29 and 30, and Western showing September 5th and 6th. The acting director of the Illinois Department of Agriculture, Jerry Costello, said, "After the cancellations of the Illinois and DuQuoin State Fairs, we knew there was a need to recognize our junior exhibitors who work year-round preparing for the fairs, so we are excited to provide modified shows that will provide an opportunity for young adults to exhibit their animals. Shows are limited to Illinois residents between the ages of 8 years and 21 years old." So, two major changes for young people in exhibiting their livestock this year. Meanwhile, we know that the state fairs in Wisconsin, Illinois, DuQuoin, and in Indiana are postponed for the year. So we'll try to keep up with that. Tomorrow was a big day on reports from the USDA. The end of the month, we'll get the actual planted acreage of our major crops, and we'll get our grain stocks report. That's Your Money on 720 WGN.
John Hansen is right across the glass. He's going to be filling in for Anna today, looking handsome as ever. Ask him about the mask that he's rocking today. John's right around the corner. Let's just spend a little time with Amy Guth. By the way, do you contemplate the sort of fashion statement that your masks make? Amy, do you worry about that at all?
I absolutely do. I have a big advantage, though, is that my mom is a very talented seamstress, and she's been sending me these beautiful handmade masks. So I do coordinate them with whatever I'm wearing that day, I admit.
People do that. I think that if people see it as a fashion accessory, they're more likely, maybe, some of us, to wear them. If it's coordinated, sometimes it actually looks like a good accessory. So more power to us. Somebody sent me one. You know, I've said before, when I get to be king someday, even though I don't want to be king anymore, it's too difficult, but they sent me a royal blue face mask with a crown right across the mouth. And that's my king for a day mask. I'm not sure I'm going to wear that one out.
I've started to kind of see people use them like bumper stickers. Like, people have slogans and sayings on them that normally you'd see on a bumper sticker or like a t-shirt or something. Some are very, you know, quite funny, but I've also seen a lot with like big smiles or funny kind of grins, like jack-o'-lantern grins and things like that. So I think it'll be interesting to see how people continue to try to have fun with this kind of compulsory accessory.
Yeah, I like the fun part, although sometimes I've seen Black Lives Matter or Trump face masks, which are political statements, among other things, and sometimes that rubs people one way or another. So you have to sort of choose your masks carefully, I would say. Talk to me a little bit about United Air Miles. You've been following the airline industry a lot on these reports, but are you looking at the miles that people are accruing?
A really interesting story. So Cranes reporter John Pletz follows the airlines for Cranes, and he seems to be just about one of the only people writing about this topic right now, which I think is really fascinating. And essentially, one of the best, most guarded secrets in the airline industry is the data around frequent flyer miles. So that is not only just how lucrative that is, but we're talking about where are those customers, what are they paying, what does that look like, just how much, you know, how valuable is that person. So United, as we talked about, I think, a couple of weeks ago, in all the airlines turmoil, United has borrowed against their frequent flyer miles. And so in doing that, they had to make a big disclosure. So there's this investor deck that is quite Googleable. It's out there. And in it, there is this data. So a lot of people that follow the airlines really closely and analysts for the industry, we're all kind of flummoxed by, whoa, this is kind of, you know, like Fort Knox. Like, this is a big deal. This is not data we ever really get to see that shows, hey, you know what? It is a very valuable customer for United. So then you can make some pretty safe assumptions about other frequent flyer programs at other carriers of just how valuable that is. Of course, you have to juxtapose that against what does that mean in this moment? Because that moving target of this recovery point for airlines has been, you know, widely, you know, it's a huge range right now because there's so many unknowns. If indeed, as we're seeing case numbers surge in other states, if that means the airlines go back to a really low capacity, obviously eventually there's going to be kind of diminishing returns for what it means to be a Mileage Plus member. You know, the whole idea there is if you fly a lot and spend a lot of money on this airline, eventually you will have free tickets somewhere. That's kind of been since 1981 when that program started. That's sort of been the, you know, the golden ring there to grab. If people are not feeling good about traveling overall because of COVID, because of a surge in number of cases, because of economic issues, maybe people have not come back to work or things like that, then suddenly there's a lot of questions around that. But just that data is out, it's really interesting. And again, John Pletz had written about that at Crain's. And I thought, you know, it was interesting. Very few people had written about that when this disclosure came out. I think it was just kind of a, wait, was that a thing? Yeah, that's a thing. That's a thing. Yeah. And there it was.
United's frequent flyer program raked in $5.3 billion selling mileage last year. About $3.8 billion came from more than 100 outside partners, such as Chase and hotels, rental car companies, and other merchants, he said. That's the kind of number you're talking about? We didn't know what the value of those were?
Yeah, we kind of knew that it was up there because, you know, as you said, there's sort of the two pieces. There's the miles that you, the flyer, get, but then there's also this big revenue generator of, you know, say JP Morgan Chase buying those miles to give to their credit card holders, things like that. So there's lots of ways to get those miles. I don't think anybody knew exactly how big that number was or what the data around it was, which I think is really interesting. I talked to Pletz earlier, and he was telling me how just knowing that the number of United Mileage Plus members that live around different airports and how that breaks out, things like that, that's really valuable information. So I think the question now, not only the recovery questions, but what does that mean for other carriers? Are other carriers going to follow suit and try to borrow against their miles numbers? I mean, the market took it very favorably. Originally, United was going to borrow a smaller number, and then after this disclosure, ended up borrowing $6.8 billion against it. So, you know, clearly it was seen as a good thing. So it'll be interesting to watch in the next few weeks what other airlines do to maybe open up this data that one analyst said something like, you have a better shot of getting into Fort Knox than taking a look at this kind of data. So this is really a big deal.
That sounds like the way Netflix guards its data. Talk to me about Gap and Kanye West. Are partners now?
Yeah, you know, it's not often that we talk about Kanye West here on the Business Lunch, but here we are. So he has announced that he is going to do a line with Gap. And what happened was that suddenly, and this is for men, women, and kids, it's called Yeezy Gap. They said this on Friday. On this announcement, Gap shares soared. So the most in at least 40 years after revealing this partnership. So that's pretty big in a moment when you and I have talked about how much retail is struggling right now. Even pre-pandemic, they were really struggling with e-commerce. And then, you know, brick and mortar establishments have been hit really hard during stay home orders, things like that. Retail in general is really struggling. So for Gap shares to go up the most in 40 years is a really, really big deal after announcing this partnership. It's a multi-year partnership. So we, you know, we got to wait and see what that looks like and what people are going to do with it. But, you know, he has a lot of brand power, and it's very easy for Kanye to put his name behind something and people respond to that. So everybody will be having to look for Yeezy Gap, see what that entails and what that'll be. But it's for, again, men, women, and kids.
So we don't know what the actual designs will be, what these clothes or shoes will look like, huh?
I haven't seen any of it yet, but, you know, I'm sure it'll be no time at all before people are posting a lot of what that looks like and what that's going to be. So, I think that's going to be really interesting because they have been grappling with a really difficult turnaround. They have, you know, they have so many different brands there. They've got Old Navy, they've got Banana Republic, they've got all these different brands that have been impacted each differently in all this. So they've already been in this turnaround moment and had kind of made some signals earlier in the year that maybe things were not looking good. And then around like March, April, it started to kind of shift a little bit. So we'll see. This is obviously a big move from Gap, and And it's a big deal for Kanye to put his brand against something. So I'm sure people are going to continue to respond. The market certainly did.
Yeah, no kidding. Although it still strikes me as an unlikely marriage. And Kanye can be controversial and just goofy sometimes. And
that's right.
I think that's a risk that Gap evidently is willing to take.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, he's a really outspoken celebrity, and sometimes he says really polarizing things and makes a lot of headlines for it, right? And people have really strong opinions because he says polarizing things. So I agree. I think it's a big risk for Gap to take. But I think in this moment of retail, where so many retailers are struggling, sometimes that risk pays off, and I think that was one that Gap's willing to take. That's a brand that's been around for a very long time, and I think that they feel like that, you know, hey, let's take something a little controversial and see what happens with it.
Okay, Amy, I'm anxious to see them, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks for your time today.
Sounds good. Thanks.